Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
I think they use their brown eyes to push a lot of the sales. They'll look and kind of bat their eyelashes, and you're opening your wallet before you know it.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and that was Matt Korbal, father of two of the region's most successful Girl Scout cookie salespersons. 11th grader Rena and 6th grader Hayden each sold about 1,600 boxes this year. This feat was accomplished through grit and some very, very long days.
Typically on a weekend, you normally spend like all day on a school day. Maybe 20 minutes after school, you're out and getting home around 8 o'clock.
Wow, that's a long time then, right? That's hours every day on school days?
Mm-hmm. Girl Scout cookie selling is a lot of fun. And I sell so well that they are offering me stuff.
Wait, like what's something you've been offered?
Car jobs.
Car jobs? Like washing cars, or what do you mean?
Selling them.
Hayden says selling at booths and door-to-door has given her a lot more self-confidence.
Well, when I first started Girl Scouts, I was really shy and afraid of most things in the world, and it was mainly my parents that were ushering me on, like, go ahead, do it. I'm just like, no, they're strangers, help. Eventually, I started to get more comfortable and understanding of the process, so that really helped. Now I'm kind of a bit more open and accepting of more things.
Things like making a little bit of a spectacle of yourself to get the attention of buyers. You know, working the angles.
Making a little chant about our best deals.
Would you possibly demonstrate this chant?
Okay, so 1 for 5, 5 for 25, 10 for 50, 12 for 60. And that's like a little chant.
You can get a rhythm going.
4 for 20, 1 for 5, come get cookies and you'll be happy. That's pretty much how that one goes.
Hey, being a top seller doesn't mean being a great poet. It's all about the hustle. And that's the theme of our show today, though it gets a little bit less wholesome from here on out. We'll hear how a seedy cartel in Seattle once controlled the pinball racket, and meet a former drug user whose hustle was representing other addicts in court. That's all ahead right here on Sound Effect from 88.5. On now to a hustle from nearly a century ago. This story is about a guy who spotted a chance to make a lot of money and went for it. His name was Roy Olmsted. Back in the 1920s, during Prohibition, Olmsted supplied a dry Northwest with booze. Lots of booze. And we're not talking moonshine here. This was the good stuff. Olmsted became known as the King of the Bootleggers. But his life did not start out this way. University of Washington history professor William Rohrabaugh says that in the early 1900s, Olmsted was a Seattle police officer.
He was Scandinavian, and he had a kind of calm, deferential demeanor. He was a bit cold, perhaps, even. He was fairly tall and broad-shouldered, and I mean, he had been a police officer who could, you know, break up a barroom fight, so he had size on his side.
Rohrabaugh talks with Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing about how Olmsted's hustle ended up, in a roundabout way, strengthening the civil liberties we still enjoy today. He says Olmsted quickly rose through the ranks of Seattle's police department, becoming the youngest lieutenant on the force.
He was very bright, capable. People thought of him as maybe someday a future police chief.
How does he go from being a rising star in the police force to getting into distributing alcohol, which was illegal?
There were people in high places who kind of encouraged him to do this. They saw that prohibition wasn't going to work. It was going to stop legal drinking. It wasn't going to stop drinking. And therefore, there would be a lot of illegal drinking. And this was bound to produce a lot of crime and criminal gangs that would take over this business. And I think they kind of encouraged him to get into the business in order to stop people who were worse from being in the business. And of course, why did he do it? Well, he later said after he was out of prison, he did it for the money. I mean, why else would you do it? You know, that was a lot of money involved.
Yeah. How much are we talking about?
Oh, he said that there were thousands of dollars a week.
A week?
A week, yeah. Maybe $200,000 a year, maybe.
How did he do this?
A lot of it was actually geography. It was the simple fact that Seattle is very close to Canada. Canada did not have prohibition. And what you had to do was find a way to get the liquor across the international border. That was the gist of it. And Olmsted's particular technique for doing it was pretty imaginative. He went up to Vancouver and he would buy Canadian liquor, and then he would load it onto Canadian boats and take these ships, fairly large ships, out into the Pacific Ocean, international waters, and then he would, at night, load the liquor onto small, fast boats that he purchased. And those small, fast boats would come back into Puget Sound during the night and would drop the liquor off on different beaches. And then car caravans would come to those beaches by some kind of prearranged signal, hopefully before someone else got there, right? And pick up the liquor and take it back to Seattle.
And how did people know where to pick up these crates of alcohol on these random beaches?
The king of the rum runners had the answer to that. He lived in Mount Baker, which is high up, right? It's on a hilltop. And he suddenly started operating a radio station out of his house, which seemed like a very odd idea. And the radio station at night, his wife, Elsie, would read children's stories. And apparently the children's stories contained secret coded messages about where the beaches were that you would pick up the liquor and what time the liquor would be there.
What did he say he was doing? What was his public persona? What business, in quotation marks and air quotes, was he running?
Oh, well, he had a really good one, didn't he? What would you do if you were hiring people to go around and do secretive things? He's a former police officer. He was a private detective, right?
Who were his clients?
Oh, the wealthiest people in Seattle. He served the hotels that supposedly were dry, the speakeasies, the high-end speakeasies. The reason people wanted liquor from Olmsted and were willing to pay higher prices is that his liquor was not moonshine.
How did the end come for the king of the rum?
Yes, well, the king fell from his throne, didn't he? There were people in Washington State who very much favored prohibition. And in fact, the voters had put state prohibition in even before national prohibition. So this was a dry state. And the leader of that politically was a senator, U.S. senator named Wesley Jones. And he was determined personally to get rid of Roy Olmsted. He saw Roy Olmsted as mocking this law. So Olmsted could pay off the police. He could pay off the mayor's office. But the one group that Olmsted could never control was the Federal Prohibition Bureau, because it was under the patronage control of Senator Jones. And so the King of the Rum Runners had an office in downtown Seattle overlooking Pioneer Square, I believe. And the feds decided that they would wiretap Roy Olmsted's office telephone downtown. And most of the phone calls were totally innocuous. And the person would say, you know, 4th and Marion, or some address. You know. And then that would be it. And then Olmsted would hang up. And they said, we have enough evidence that there's something funny going on, because this guy's not talking on the phone in a normal way.
It's not what he's saying, it's what he's not saying.
Right. Let's have a search warrant for his house. I think it was like a Friday night. It was a party night. I know that. And the feds, you know, raided the place and found the liquor that was going to be distributed at the end of the party, as well as, of course, the liquor was going to be served at the party. But more important, they found all the records. So, I mean, his attorney says, look, the wiretap was illegal, and therefore the search warrant was illegal, and therefore this whole case is illegal. The searches are illegal without warrants, but whether tapping somebody's phone wire constitutes a search is a really interesting legal question in 1924.
So this is uncharted territory.
It's uncharted territory legally. There's no law against it, but there's also no law that allows it. And the judge isn't buying any of Olmsted's lawyer's argument and says, doesn't seem like it's an illegal search to me. So he loses the case and is convicted. And then his attorney says, but we could win on appeal, and So it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 ruling, ruled against Olmstead. Chief Justice William Howard Taft hated prohibition, absolutely despised it, disapproved of it totally.
So you would think he would rule in Olmstead's favor.
But he argued with his colleagues on the court, if we let bootleggers like Olmstead off on technicalities, which is what this is, then we'll never get rid of the 18th Amendment. The only way we can get rid of that amendment is if we convict them. We have to crack down on bootleggers and make it hard for people to get liquor. And then people will scream, get rid of the amendment. So the court, 5-4, it shows you that, you know, some of the justices didn't buy that argument, obviously. But there's a huge outcry in the legal community from attorneys who say, this should be covered by the Fourth Amendment. No one should have a right to tap somebody's telephone like that without a warrant. And Congress in the 1930s passes a statute that specifically prohibits a wiretap without a warrant. So Congress settled the matter eventually.
And Roy Olmstead goes to prison.
He's sentenced to 5 years, I believe, at McNeil Island. And by the time he's released, prohibition is about over. And while he's in prison, he has a religious conversion experience and becomes a Christian Scientist and becomes totally dry. And he becomes a furniture salesman for a while. And later he becomes a full-time Christian Science practitioner. It is also suspected, although no one can prove it, that he probably had money in bank accounts in Vancouver. The feds would have been willing to maybe even give him a very light sentence instead of 5 years if he'd been willing to tell everything.
But he never did.
And even his children said he never would talk about it. He just said, that was then, this is now.
William Rarbaugh, a professor of history at the University of Washington, thank you so much for joining us on Sound Effect.
You're welcome.
And we should tell our listeners that you have a book coming out in the fall called Prohibition, A Concise History.
That story from Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing. Welcome back to Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're telling tales of the hustle. The hustle holds a special place in the culture of the Roma people. At least, that's how Miller Steve describes it. He grew up in Tacoma's Roma community in the 1970s and 80s. Back then, it was a close-knit bunch of families descended from a nomadic minority group in Europe. Miller Steve says, for the Roma, the hustle is about more than just making money. It's a way of life that's taught starting in childhood. He spoke with 88.5's Will James.
The way Miller Steve tells it, if you want to understand everything good and bad that's happened in his life, you have to understand what it means to be Roma. For him, it meant growing up in a huge family in Tacoma, in a house full of aunts, uncles, and cousins who spoke their own language at home, an ancient language with roots in India.
Sokreden is, how are you doing? Tuch san chisto dilo is you're very stupid.
You probably know the Roma by a different name, a name they don't like.
You don't use the word gypsy, because gypsy is like being gypped. It's a bad word.
So Roma. They originally came from India, but spent centuries traveling around Europe, dodging persecution. The Nazis killed thousands of Roma in the Holocaust. And that's important because being Roma means being a survivor. Miller says lessons in survival have bled into almost every aspect of Roma culture, even the tradition of fortune-telling.
They could read eyes, they could read, you know, the expression on a person's face of what they're thinking.
Is that something you were taught growing up, or just something you picked up?
I think it's something just embedded in us, is because of the fear.
It's a talent, he says, helped them stay one step ahead of danger. Miller and I talk in the game room of his apartment complex outside Portland, where he's been thinking a lot lately about how Roma culture shaped the way he grew up in Tacoma. As a kid, he helped his dad sell RVs at the family's franchise, where his parents drilled in lessons about survival. That meant growing up fast and learning how to hustle. He learned how to make quick money buying and selling cars or finding work on a construction site.
You had to have a car at the age of 14, 15 years old. You had to be smart, like a man, because they didn't want you to have that teenager life, that wild life.
And he didn't live like a typical American teenager. Instead, he had a grown-up life. At 13, he was drinking, making money, driving himself to school. Like a lot of Roma kids, he was married at 15. But growing up fast came at a cost for Miller. In exchange for those real-world lessons in business and adulthood, he lost out on a formal education. His parents didn't want him to get to college.
They wanted us to have a little education, but not a lot, because they were afraid of the drugs, the sex. They kept putting me back every time we moved. We moved 3 times, and every time I would get to 6th grade, they would go and put me back to 4th or 5th.
He never made it past the 6th grade. The reason Miller Steve is thinking about all this lately is because he can't get a job. Over the years, he's bought and sold vehicles, dealt in scrapping, worked on driveways and roofs, but now he's in his 40s with a family to support, and he's struggling to find something steadier. Even though he's got a lifetime of business experience, he says when employers look at his resume, they just see a guy with a 6th grade education.
Today, companies, they want to interview on a computer. If they really met me, I think I could give any job I wanted. You know, I could be an executive. I have the tools. But they won't hire me because they read the paper. You know, and some days I'm good, and some days I'm like, you know, months, like, oh, this is looking pretty grim.
He has this feeling that if things had gone just a little bit differently, maybe if he had stuck with school, his life would be a lot easier today. Maybe he'd be putting those business skills to use in a corner office or a boardroom somewhere. And he's not the first person in his family to think this way. Back in the 90s, one of Miller's relatives helped start a program designed to integrate Roma kids into Tacoma public schools. That relative, Kaiser Stevens, spoke with KNKX News director Aaron Hennessy back in 1992 for a story for NPR. Kaiser Stevens dreamed of seeing the first Roma kids in the Northwest graduate from high school. But first, he had to convince Roma parents, who were afraid the schools would water down their culture.
And then I kind of come back at them and tell them that our way of living is dying out. And there's some things that you're going to have to give up, which I'm hoping that we could still keep our culture intact and still have the education.
Again, he thought it was possible to both get an education and keep the Roma culture alive. But Kaiser Stevens died years ago, and so did his program. I asked the Tacoma School District, and no one's really sure why. Maybe it's because Tacoma's Roma community has just kind of drifted apart over the years. Miller says a welfare fraud crackdown years ago played a role in breaking up the community.
Yes, I remember that raid. It was like I get up early, and it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I remember on Jackson, I looked over to my cousin's house, his kids were on the street. He was on the street, his wife, there was like 7, 8 of them, they was just surrounded by FBI, unmarked sheriffs. It woke them up, and it startled the community, and a lot of people left.
So yeah, this whole conversation, you've pointed out ways that growing up in the Roma community has been a blessing in your life, and also ways in which you feel like it has held you back a little bit. I mean, would you say it's more of a blessing or more of an obstacle?
Well, the way I look at it now is more of a blessing, because I know I struggle, but I have more time with my kids. I have more time with my family. And I enjoy my life because I'm my own boss. And I have these talents. If I really want to make money and put my mind to it, I just have to go out there and work.
Miller's plans for the future don't involve school. Instead, he wants to break into something he calls advisory, which he says is not the same as fortune telling.
I want to be a mind advisor, where a person will come to me and tell me what they're doing, and then I would advise them how to handle their business, how to handle their relationships, because I've been through a lot. And I'm very good at coaching. That's what the Roma people are really good at. They could read people.
So for Miller Steve, the hustle continues. And here's the thing. Despite all the ways he says a lack of formal education has held him back, despite all his misgivings about the Roma way of life, he decided to homeschool his four daughters and raise them in the Roma tradition. Part of it is that his parents are still alive and have a say in how his kids are raised. But part of it is those same old fears of corrupting influences and an adherence to the power of the hustle.
I didn't want them to learn the stuff I learned at school because the stuff I learned in school, I don't use today. It's just nonsense. You know, I learned about dinosaurs, which, okay. But they didn't teach me how to live and a successful life and how to live in this world. They just taught me history, which I could teach my kids that. So, and then I could teach them more about how the real world works.
So the hustle lives on in them as well. I ask Miller if he worries about his daughters, whether they'll be able to achieve their dreams without a formal education. He says real Roma don't dream of prestige or success. They dream of having children and grandchildren and protecting them. He says it's a matter of survival.
EDH5's Will James. If you're just joining us, this is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories about people who know how to hustle. College is really expensive, and if you're lucky, you have parents who set up a college fund. Gracelyn Shibayama is our member relations coordinator here at KNKX, and when she was 17, she had a college fund, but then she got an email from her parents.
We had to use your college fund to pay for Calvin's rehab. So at that point, it was like, oh, okay, so if I want to go to college, which I thought that was going to be there, I'm going to have to start thinking about it now.
Gracelyn's family was falling apart. And now the money that she was relying on to help pay for her future was suddenly gone. But Gracelyn was determined not to let that derail her. She resolved to find the thousands of dollars she would need for tuition at the University of Washington's Bothell campus. But to do that, she would need to hustle. In her case, that meant telling complete strangers about some of the darkest moments of her life.
Financial aid offices are my really good friends. I spent a lot of time in those offices, and I found out that I could apply for something called a hardship circumstance.
So how did you go about negotiating that? What did you do?
I started with having to get letters from my loved ones, guidance counselors, therapists, and just basically stating that she definitely needs help and she does not have financial support.
You're giving evidence, essentially.
Yes.
So what did you tell them? For example, what did you say about what happened when you were 16?
I wrote a letter about the situation that was happening within my family. I shared a lot of emails with them that my parents had written to me, which were pretty heartbreaking. And so I had to reread those letters to figure out which ones were the best ones to send along.
What can you tell me about the nature of the conflict in your family?
Well, there was some drug use. My brother had gotten involved with some drugs, and so that created a little bit of a rift between myself and him. We used to be very close. We were my best friends growing up. So when he started doing heroin, I started feeling a little like, whoa, maybe I don't want to support this part of what my brother's doing. And so I started being kind of vocal about it. My parents felt that I was spreading malicious rumors about him and not actually helping. And so it was a 3-1 at that point.
What was the last straw?
One night, I came home a little bit late from curfew, and I got into a lot of trouble for being late. And at that time, I was smoking cigarettes, and my mother did not approve of that at all. And so she dumped out my purse and found a pack of cigarettes and a lighter and started screaming at me. And then my brother came home from a quote-unquote doctor's appointment that he said he had. So he took money from my parents to go to this doctor's appointment and came back with a pill bottle saying I got a new prescription that happened to have a date that was like a year old on it. And so they knew that he was not using that money to go to the doctor. It created this huge yelling match between myself and my brother and my mother. And then she said, I f-ing hate you and I hope you die. Get out of my house. I never want to see you again. So Calvin and I left.
What do you remember about what was going through your head at that time?
I remember it being really scary and it really sucked. And that was actually the first time I saw my brother do heroin in front of me, because he was so stressed out because we didn't know where we were going or what we were doing. So he took me to a coworker, one of my coworkers' houses, and I stayed there for a few days. And when I got home, my mother had told me, you can no longer live in our house. I'm adopted. I was adopted from Paraguay when I was one. And so my options from my mother were, we will put you back in foster care, you can live on the streets, or you can go to Mercer Island and live with your aunt and uncle, and we can try to salvage the family. So there wasn't really any option there. It was going to Mercer Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you feel like saying about your brother and what happened to him?
I miss him. So my brother passed away 5 years ago this year, April 28th, 2012. And it was of an overdose. It wasn't a shock. I'd kind of always had it in the back of my mind that one of these days I was going to get the phone call that my brother had passed. And I was so ready for it. And then I got the phone call and I broke down. You can never be ready for something like that. I mean, we weren't the best of friends towards the end of his life because of everything that had happened, but he'll always be my big brother.
I'm really sorry, Gracelyn. Did that have an effect on your relationship then with your parents? You must have had to encounter them in the wake of that.
I emailed my father because he was a little more level-headed. I emailed him and said, I'm so sorry for the loss of Calvin. And then he wrote me back, and I didn't respond for a few days. I hadn't seen the email. And when I went to respond, it had apparently been too long of a time. So he was already angry that I didn't respond instantly. And his response was, I wanted to meet with you, but since you are not responding to us, we never want to see you again. You abandoned the family. And you abandoned your brother. And then we were told that they weren't going to have any kind of memorial service for him, but they did have one. And that shattered me. So I struggle every day thinking how I can say goodbye to my brother.
So the process of going back through all that stuff, reliving it, putting it all in an email with these kind of bureaucrats on the other end of your email chain.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff that you had to share was so intimate, but it's in this such a strange context. It's like you're sharing it, something you might normally share with your therapist or your counselor or your close loved ones. Now you're sharing it with like the admin people at the University of Washington. I mean, what made you think it was worth it?
I'm a pretty hard-headed person. And when my college fund was taken away, it was almost like, well, I don't need you anyway. I'm going to do it on my own. So I was able to do it with the love and support of other people.
Yeah. So tell us what happened.
I ended up getting financial assistance, and I got my entire college paid for with grants and scholarships, and I graduated without any student loans. So that's pretty remarkable.
And do you feel like you learned anything or got any insights from that weird exercise of having to dredge it up?
Oh, yeah. I was a really good student. I was not about to let any of my grades fall at all, because if I started failing, I would have to start paying money back. That money that they gave me was only there if I actually completed college. So it made me really value my education, and I was determined to say, you know, I can do anything without financial help. As long as I have love in my life, I know I'll be able to accomplish it. I love my aunt and uncle. I don't know where I would be without them. And I'm one really lucky person to have landed there, to think of all of the families I could have landed with. And then this is where I really found my home. And earlier this year, I decided to take on the last name of my aunt and uncle to feel more connected to them and feel like, you know, this is my family. This is where I belong.
Gracelyn Shibayama is member relations coordinator and bulldog wrangler here at KNKX. Gracelyn, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is The Hustle. And so for this next tale of The Hustle, I'm bringing in a ringer. She is the Morning Edition producer and reporter here at KNKX, Ariel Van Cleve. Welcome, Ms. Van Cleve.
Thank you very much.
So what is this all about, The Hustle, as related to?
Pinball Man. I read a charming article in The Herald about Raymond Davidson, who is actually the third-ranked player in the world who lives in Mukilteo. He's 24. So I thought, how sweet and nice this is. I'll do a story about him.
Yeah, it sounds quaint.
Quaint,
almost,
to say the least, right?
Right, pinball is sort of feels a little retro these days,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a kind Xboxes of a feel-good thing. Yeah, absolutely. But it turns out the history of pinball around here is not so quaint.
This took a dark turn.
It really did quickly.
Why you gotta ruin pinball? What's next? I mean, is Connect Four next? So where did this take you?
Well, in the 1950s and 60s, pinball was considered gambling and was basically outlawed. But it was tolerated. So Christopher Bailey, who is the former King County prosecutor around this time, he actually explained what this tolerance policy actually was.
The city decided officially, the council and the mayor, to tolerate a certain level of illegal activity, knowing that it was illegal by state law, all kinds of gambling, but deciding that if they licensed it and controlled it, it would keep out the big bad boys from back east who were known to be even worse than the local gamblers. So that was the theory, and it was based on certain things you wouldn't imagine would be worth much, like pinball machines.
Right.
But they generated tens of millions of dollars of revenue, taverns particularly, bars. But the people who really made money were the owners of the machines, and they were formed into cartels.
This idea of a pinball cartel, what did that look like?
The structure was basically one of control, so that if you wanted to get revenue from a pinball machine or have your tavern benefit from people coming in and playing, you had to buy one or license one. And the reason it's a cartel is that there are a limited number of licenses. But it was the reason for the police payoff system. And if you didn't have a license, the police could shut you down, or they'd come along and maybe enforce the liquor laws more seriously.
Well, and I think what's bizarre is that it's pinball. Like, card games, I understand, brothels, but pinball machines,
yeah,
become the thing?
Pinballs were a very popular form of recreation. Television was sort of just getting started. A lot of amusement things that were done outside the home were a source of recreation for many, many people. So if you could generate money out of that, it was very lucrative. Nowadays, you know, you see a pinball machine as kind of a relic.
Well, and I you're talking about lucrative. In the book, you mentioned that profits that were generated were as high as $25 million in 1964. That's almost $200 million in today's money.
Right, right.
That's extreme.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, and it's all from people putting quarters in a slot, which is kind of amazing.
Along with it being a lucrative thing, it was also a dangerous thing to have pinball machines and be a vendor or have a license to have a pinball machine. And between 1958 and 1960, in particular, there are these two brothers who showed up and kind of wreaked havoc.
The Colacurcio brothers.
That's right.
Yeah, they're very well known, not for this, though, because most of their illegal activity was stripper clubs and things like that.
Mm.
But because of the money in the pinballs, the Colacurcios did attempt to break into it by becoming a licensee or master licensee. And there was actually some violence. There were a couple of bombings that were attributed to them. But basically, the city council was not favorable to that. They liked to control the system and have the illegal activity, something that was licensed by the people they knew. They didn't want any new people in the business. One of the myths that allowed the city council to maintain control was this idea that these are our gamblers, our illegal activities. We could keep a lid on it. Nobody's going to get hurt. But we don't want those other guys coming in.
And I want to talk about Ben Saichi in particular, because he held, he was the president of the Far West Novelty Company. And that company, that held the sole license in the county.
Yeah, he's a very interesting character who we don't know much about other than the fact that he held a master license. And he was a very close friend of the King County prosecutor, Charles O'Carroll. In fact, one of the things in the book is a shadowy photograph of a meeting that happened once a month. Saichi came to Carroll's house up on Capitol Hill, and an enterprising PI photographer hid in the bushes and captured a picture of Saichi coming out, Carroll saying goodbye, and he had a black bag in his hand, which is, looks, you know, you can only imagine what was in the black bag. It all began to unravel in the 2 years before the 1970 election.
This bombshell of a photo that was taken in 1968 with Ben Saichi and Chuck Carroll, that was sort of the start of the cracks being formed in this tolerance policy. But it was also, there's some mystery surrounding Ben Saichi and what happened to him as well. Can you explain?
Yes, it's a big mystery. And about a year later, in 1969, Ben Saichi, who was a wealthy man, he lived in Yarrow Point. He had a very nice yacht parked out in front at the pier. And one afternoon on a Saturday, he was working on his boat. His wife was in the house. She was making lunch. He had a couple of callers, and she went out to get him, and they couldn't find him. He was found later in 10 feet of water. He'd fallen off his boat, or he was pushed. Nobody really knows. When someone dies like that, there's an autopsy, and the coroner is involved, and they call the coroner himself, who was up at Whidbey Island, and he said, no, don't do the autopsy. I'll do it myself on Monday. It was done on Monday without any witnesses. The death was ruled accidental, and Dr. Wilson, the coroner, was Chuck Carroll's brother-in-law. So, what are you supposed to think?
I'm a big fan of pinball. I'd like to go and play it. I don't think about it in terms of being a part of a corrupt gambling system.
It's not
system.
Even a bad habit, right?
I know. It's just for fun.
Right.
But this is dangerous, what you're talking about, and how do you express the gravity of the situation?
You talk about the money, and you talk about the way the money corrupted the police department. And it also allows you to underline how important who the prosecuting attorney is for the city and the county.
Well, Christopher Bailey, thank you so much for your book and for your work and for coming in today.
And thank you for inviting me and for being the station that connects us with NPR News and all that jazz.
You're tuned to Sound Effect, and today our show is all about the hustle. About 20 years ago, Will Miller was an unlikely drug addict who had to hustle to support his very demanding habit. Unlikely because Will was a King County prosecutor. He's gay, and in the late 90s, he was spending a lot of time in gay bars.
And in 1997, methamphetamine was everywhere in the gay bar scene in Seattle. It was definitely a drug that seemed to appeal to gay men at that place and time.
Will had experimented with other drugs while he was in college and never got addicted, so he thought the same thing would be true for meth, but he was wrong.
Cocaine will take your dopamine level up to 350 units for an hour, but meth will take your dopamine levels up to 1,250 units and keep them there for 12 to 24 hours. And once you've experienced that high a couple of times, you know, ideas like self-control and free will, they become very theoretical concepts.
Yeah. So what does that feel like for people who have not experienced it?
Well, of course, you're wide awake. You feel endlessly energetic. You're happy in a very unnatural way. I mean, your brain is not really built to deal with that level of dopamine. It also has the ability to mimic confidence in your brain. Like everything that comes to mind seems like a great idea. And if you're a gay man in the 90s and you're a little overweight and you're a little self-conscious, and it played into every one of my weaknesses.
So you're going to work every day, or at least most days, and you're using it some kind of a functional level. How did it start to catch up with you?
Well, I started sleeping less and less. I couldn't predict when I was going to fall asleep, so I started showing up later and later for work. I would often get a call from my secretary saying, "Where are you?" And I remember one night doing meth late into the night, falling asleep, and then getting that phone call again. And I just flew into action. I grabbed my briefcase, I threw on a suit, I ran down to the courthouse, and I went through the metal detector. And when I put my briefcase through, they asked me to open it. And I didn't think anything of it. I often had my briefcase searched on the way in. It's a normal thing for security reasons. But when they opened it, they found a metal pipe and a small baggie of meth. The guards came out and they confronted me, and I made up a story saying, I'm sure this belongs to my roommate. He's a drug addict. He was actually my partner at the time. You know, all that was true. And initially it worked. I mean, I went up immediately to my bosses and resigned. I told them that there was meth in my briefcase, that I didn't want to talk about it, and that they needed to let me go. So I didn't go back to work after that. But that case got assigned to a special prosecutor, and it was investigated. And eventually they did not charge me. They believed me that I would not have knowingly carried meth into the courthouse. And the thing is, if they had charged me, my case would have gone to drug court. And I would have had this life-saving intervention that I so desperately needed. I needed to be prosecuted for that initial possession. But because they didn't charge me, I kept using. When they finally decided not to charge me, there was a big scandal. There were editorials being written by the Public Defender's Office. The Seattle Weekly ran an article with my picture. And my name, and that was it. My legitimate law practice, what I was trying to do to become a criminal defense attorney, it was over.
After you got busted, and while you were waiting to find out whether you were going to be prosecuted, you say you kept using, but you also kept practicing, right?
Yeah, I did. Everybody needs their hustle. when you enter the world of drug addicts, you realize that's true. There's people that work as prostitutes, people that are drug dealers, people who steal mail and sell it to identity thieves, people who are forgers. So all those people were around me. I met them all at drug deals. I bought drugs from them. And they all needed a criminal defense attorney. And I filled that function. And I got paid in meth.
Representing other addicts.
Correct. Yeah. They were the people I know from drug deals who became my friends, who became my clients.
So how did this chapter of your career come to an end?
Okay, so when the Seattle Weekly ran the article with my picture and I lost all my business, that was it. I needed a new hustle. And there's only one really profitable hustle in that world, and that's you buy your drugs in bulk so you can get your own for free. And the person who I'd originally gotten addicted with, who I'd kicked out of my house, started calling me and started asking me if I could please help him set up a series of drugs deals with a fisherman he knew from Bellingham. It was somebody I had some bad blood with. I should have known better. That person was setting me up for the police department for a fee. At the fourth deal, there was suddenly a battering ram at the front door.
Go.
And it came blowing off its hinges.
There it goes.
Go, 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 go. Police,
and my house police. Was flooded with a SWAT team. And a Como 4 news team who decided to interrupt the evening broadcast to film my arrest live.
You had live cameras in your house as
yep.
you were getting arrested?
Yes. They came in violation of the search warrant. They brought a news crew into my house to film it going down.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So what became of those charges then? What happened next?
I forced the court to allow me to co-counsel my own case while I was high on meth. The jury was out for 3 days before they convicted me, and thank God they did, because it was the thing that saved my life.
And so how long did you wind up serving?
2 years exactly.
So during that time, how did you come to think about your addiction and what you needed to stay clean? I mean, did you get perspective or clarity on it?
Yeah, prison is the poor man's rehab. Like, I needed a 2-year inpatient drug rehab with a bunch of other addicts whose lives had been destroyed by drugs. And prison was perfect for that. And, you know, there were those horrible times where I got recognized and I was in danger. But overall, totally worth it. The experience was totally worth it. Two of my very best friends were two of my former cellmates, even today. And once you get 2 years of clean time under your belt, it's so much easier to stay clean.
But you come out as this person who's now publicly outed as an addict, somebody who's been disbarred, somebody whose career is seemingly over. How are you not just a shattered human at that point?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with being gay. You know, when I grew up gay in the 60s and 70s, we were just as stigmatized then as people getting out of prison now. We were considered criminals. We were kicked out of our families. We were exiled into ghettos. So I got out and I was determined, first of all, to stay in the law in some capacity. So I moved my parole to North Carolina and I got a job as a paralegal. And for the next 8.5 years, I was a secretary, a paralegal, and an office manager in a law firm. And it was those people in the South that really talked me in to trying to get my license back in Washington State as an attorney. And I was like, come on, I've got 4 felony convictions. You know, I'm not getting my license back. But, you know, they were people of faith, and I am not. And they said that they had faith that I could pull it off. And then they said they'd pay for it. They'd pay for whatever it took to try. And they did. They followed through on that. And slowly, slowly, over the course of 8.5 years, I took baby step after baby step to build a case for myself to get readmitted. And in 2009, I came back. I had my hearing before the Bar Association. I represented myself again this time not on meth. Turns out you're much more effective that way. And 7 out of 10 members of that committee voted to reinstate me. And then the Supreme Court approved it.
How did this experience, going through the criminal justice system as a defendant and then serving time in prison, make you think differently about crime and about the people who commit crimes, the people you had spent years prosecuting?
Having gone through prison and having been on the other side of the law, you know, there's a tremendous amount of compassion I have for anybody, especially people who end up committing crimes because of drugs. And that's like 95% of the prison population. You either sold drugs or you were caught with drugs or you committed a crime so you could buy drugs. That being said, I'm very, very cynical about people coming out of addiction. You really have to have a few years under your belt before I believe you, because too many times I've just seen people relapse and relapse and relapse. It breaks your heart if you get in too close.
Will Miller is a lawyer with the Story Law Firm within the Eastside Collaborative Law Center, which is based in Bellevue. Thank you so much, Will.
Thank you.
That's our show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing. Special thanks to Shane Mailing, Ariel Van Cleve, Will James, Lowell Kiso, and Allie Ferguson. We get multimedia help from Parker Miles Blom. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. And one more reminder that your contributions are what make Sound Effect and this whole station possible. It's fall fun drive time, so go to knkx.org to make your gift. And come back next week when our theme is Bug in the System. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.